Good afternoon, everybody. We would like to get started. We don't have a quorum just yet, but we do have quite a few things on the agenda, so it would probably be a good idea for us to get started. And we're going to start with Representative Allen's bill, House Bill 1115. Welcome to the committee, Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We don't have a quorum yet. We can't move your bill, but we can certainly start talking about it. And as soon as we do get a quorum, we'll pause and move the bill. So,
and at that time, Madam Chair, we can move we have an amendment as well.
Absolutely. So, if you want to just state your name for the record, and we can start talking about the issue.
Representative Susan Allen, presenting House File 1115. The Medical Malpractice Act work group was created by the 2012 legislature, and the group's task was to ensure that the Medical Malpractice Act protected the safety and well-being of the citizens of the state and allowed for transparency. The report was issued in January of this year. And that report found that the Medical Malpractice Act was adequate, but recommended certain technical changes that are in this bill. And the Board of Medical Malpractice has reviewed all changes and finds the changes acceptable.
Representative Allen,
yes.
You keep saying medical malpractice.
I'm sorry, medical
practice.
Medical
a lawyer
practice,
mistake.
Yes. Yes, thank you. Medical Practice Group Act. And then we have Madam Chair, we have one testifier.
All right. Thank you, Representative Allen. Welcome to the committee.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Matthew Colley. I'm the Legislative Policy Director for the Minnesota Department of Health. And I'm here because Malcolm Mitchell, who was the chair of the work group, was originally scheduled to testify, was unable to make it today. I think Representative Allen gave a pretty good overview of the recommendations. The work group did put out a report. It was unanimous in its recommendations. They are of a technical nature, as the review of the Medical Practice Act found that, from the work group's perspective, that the act was sufficient to protect the public and allow for transparency. And on the amendment, it will just be a couple of additions of recommendations that failed to make it into the bill draft, but
okay.
Are in the report.
Mr. Colley, we can pause there because we do have a quorum. So Representative Allen will move that House File 1115 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. And then Representative Allen will move the A2 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape in which she wants to have it before the committee. So, correct, Representative Allen?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, so all in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. So we now have the House File 1115 as amended. And Mr. Colley, anything else you want to say about it?
No, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. And Representative Allen, before I go back to you, let me just see if there's anybody here who wants to testify for or against the bill. Okay, not seeing anybody. Representative Allen?
Madam Chair, there was a question from an interested party regarding the actual changes, and one of them, the changes, was the diversionary program, and that's for clarification purposes only, to clarify what the purpose of the health professional services program does and who may participate in that program. And then there was another section that was added oversight of allied health professionals, and this was added merely as a cross reference, and so it doesn't change any regulatory oversight. It's just a matter of adding a cross reference.
Okay. Questions from members? Okay, and looks like we have another testifier. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Malcolm Mitchell. I was privileged to chair the medical practice work group, and I'm sorry to be late, but I was just in Rochester, down Mayo, and just got back. My only comment, and I don't know what you've heard already, is that it was a very diverse, good group that worked on this, that we had six meetings, and there was really, we had a lot of information. We learned a lot. We paid a lot of attention to the information that we received about the Health Service Professional Organization and by the auditor's report, and as a result, we really felt there were no major gaps, although we did recommend some changes in terms of aggregate data and making it more easily understood by the public. And the recommendations you have here are, we think, non-controversial. And so I'll stand on that and answer any questions.
All right. So questions from members. All right. Not seeing any. So Representative Allen will renew her motion that House File 1115, as amended, be recommended to pass and go to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you.
Okay. Next bill on the agenda is House File 1002. And Mr. Bergeron just stepped out to get Representative Schoen. And while he's doing that, can we have a motion to approve the minutes? We have two sets of minutes from March 14th and March 15th. Is there a motion? Representative Grunhagen?
Yeah, I'll move the minutes.
Representative Grunhagen moves to approve the minutes of March 14th and March 15th. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Welcome to the committee, Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Schoen is going to move his bill, House File 1002, that it be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Civil Law.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, this is a bill just related to background checks. I won't talk long about it. I'll let my fantastic testifier give the history about it, and then I can talk about some at the end if needed. But this is fairly non-controversial and has already been through the Senate as well. But I know we've got plenty to do, so I'll shut up.
All right. Well, Representative Schoen, when you tell us it's been through the Senate, you never know which way that can
cut. Yeah, I know.
So
that's why I threw in the I should shut up.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Shirley Brecken, the Executive Director of the Board of Nursing, and today I'm speaking on behalf of all of the health-related licensing boards and asking your support for this bill, which will give the boards the authority to require criminal background checks of applicants for licensure. What I'd like to do is a couple of things. First of all, tell you how the boards arrived at this point and then capture what the bill does. Last year, some of the boards came forward with various provisions for criminal background checks for applicants for licensure. Because they were not consistent, we were directed to go back to the drawing board and come back with a bill that a process that would be common to all the boards. In addition to working amongst ourselves, we also worked with stakeholders that had some concerns. We addressed those concerns, and as a result, we are not aware of any further opposition, and in fact have the support of the Minnesota Council on Crime and Justice. The health-related licensing boards were created by the legislature to protect the public and to ensure the safety of the public in the delivery of care. This is a significant responsibility. Healthcare professionals such as doctors and nurses and dentists and social workers care for people in some of their most vulnerable moments across the lifespan and in settings as varied as private homes, schools, prisons, hospitals, clinics, and nursing homes. While the vast majority of healthcare professionals are safe, ethical, caring practitioners, it is imperative that the boards have the effective tools to identify individuals who pose a risk to patients. The boards believe that conviction of certain crimes have a potential impact on the ability to practice a profession safely or foreshadow how an individual might treat vulnerable persons in his or her care. And we believe that should be considered as part of the licensing decisions. Currently, the boards rely on self-disclosure of an individual's criminal history with questions on the application for licensure. Unfortunately, not all applicants are as forthright as we would like them to be. The boards also investigate a complaint, complaints alleging criminal conduct by licensees or applicants. So this bill would provide that all applicants for licensure by examination or endorsement, that means they're licensed in another state and are coming to Minnesota, will be required to submit fingerprints for a background check. Both state and federal records will be checked based on the applicant's fingerprints. Completing a background check at the time of licensure provides verification of the applicant's self-disclosure. Some boards find a significant amount of underreporting. This includes failing to disclose those convictions at all or just disclosing some but not all of the individual's convictions. The bill provides that fingerprints will be submitted to the FBI through the BCA, and that's as required by law. Consideration of convictions will be treated on a case-by-case basis. There will be no predetermined bars to licensure. That is what the boards do now. The change will be how we get the information. The boards will continue to regard the Criminal Rehabilitation Act, that requires a board may not deny a license based solely on conviction. A nexus to the practice of the profession must be established, and a concern for risk of harm to the public must be substantiated. The individual will have the right to challenge the accuracy of the report. Now, while the bill specifically applies to applicants for licensure, the bill does provide a provision to develop a plan to determine if and how to conduct criminal background checks on current licensees. The key will be working with the Department of Human Services to minimize duplication of background checks. The plan must also be contingent upon a wrap-back function. That is, once a licensee's fingerprints are on record, any crime the individual commits will trigger a report to the board. Any authority related to background checks for licensees would require the boards to come back to the legislature for that authority. Requiring criminal background checks supports uniform licensure requirements from state to state. For example, 37 medical boards and 36 nursing boards in the country already require criminal background checks for licensure. The authority to do criminal background checks will give the Minnesota health-related licensing boards an additional tool to better protect the public. Thank you for your attention, and I'm available for any questions. Additionally, there are other executive directors from the other health-related licensing boards here who I'm sure would be happy to answer questions also.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Brecken. And we have a question from Representative Abler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm glad to see this bill come forward. Last year, this was much more controversial, and there were multiple versions drifting around, I think no less than three, looking at different groups. And I'm really glad that at the end of session and in the interim time that they've come together with a single plan that is so solid. One part I wasn't aware of, just at least, can you tell me why it's 2018 and not 2016 or 15?
Ms. Brecken.
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, some of the boards are ready to go now. Some of the boards, including the Board of Nursing, the Board of Dentistry, the Board of Physical Therapy, the Board of Psychology, have studied this issue for a while and have, you know, made these attempts to get to having that authority. Some of the other health-related licensing boards understand they need to get there, but they just aren't, they haven't gone through the study that we have and the determination of proceeding. So it says by 2018, that means they can use that time to get ready to do that. They also can watch how we do it and see how it goes and see how to make it work for them.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
Well, I think that's a prudent thing. The boards are all different. Some are very small and some are massive, case in point. But I'm happy. This is a good bill, and it's a lot of good work has gone into it, and people should support it.
Is there anybody else who wants to testify for or against the bill? Okay, not seeing anybody. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Brackett. This is good work, and I like to see the different boards working together. The one area that I would really hope you'd also work together on is in prevention and in terms of letting potential scholars or students of these areas know that there are licensing barriers if you have problems in your past, because and I think some do a good job of working with the colleges of higher education, but I've heard really tragic stories of people who've turned their lives around and really want to go into a helping profession because they've seen what that can do in their own life, and go into debt with student loans, complete the program, are so proud, so glad, go to licensing and find out that what happened in their past can't be erased and can't be waived. And I just think we need to let them know before they've gone through that system of study, before they've, you know, gone into debt, that they're going to have to look at other options depending upon what's in their background, and that you're a resource to any of their students in terms of exploring that.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, thank you for that input, and I will certainly bring that back to the executive directors. I know some of them do speak to students when they're about to graduate, but maybe earlier would be better.
Okay, Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Ms. Brecken, this is a sort of a follow-up on Representative Loeffler's question. I thought I heard you say that the boards do not necessarily have to say that some of these prior convictions are a mandatory exclusion then from getting a license, that you have the ability to look at what, look at when and what happened with that individual and make other decisions other than saying no.
Ms. Brecken.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, that's correct. That's what the boards do now. We may get a report of a criminal conviction, or we may get self-disclosure, and the investigation is involves getting court records and information regarding the not only the conviction but the rehabilitation. The boards are also bound by the Criminal Rehabilitation Act that we must establish that the practice the conviction it has a nexus to the practice of the profession, as well as causes a risk of harm. You know, there's a risk of harm to the public. There are some criteria in that law that require the boards to consider how long ago was the conviction, what kind of rehabilitation has occurred. You know, that kind of criteria, and so there is. The boards cannot deny a license based solely on that conviction, but have to consider all of that criteria.
Okay, Representative.
I hope I answered his question.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Aren't there some that are like automatic disqualifications? I thought in statute there's permanent 15-year, 7-year disqualifications. Aren't those automatic, so you can't override those?
Ms. Brecken.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, what you're referring to is the disqualification or consideration by the Department of Human Services for disqualification from employment. This is for licensure.
Sorry. Okay, Representative Abler.
Well, Madam Chair, to that point, actually two boards do have high standards for that. The chiropractors have a very thoughtful thing that came up. They have a 10-year bar, rebuttable at the end of 10 years. Permanent bar, but it's rebuttable. The medical board has a permanent bar that's not rebuttable. And there was some effort. The House, in fact, voted to have all the boards subject to that, and that kind of fell apart.
That's the sexual
misconduct. For sex crimes. But that's only two boards have that. So. And I think all the boards pretty well agreed that we should do that, but that kind of just fell aside.
Yeah. So I'd like to ask a question, too. And I have to say, I have a little bit of mixed feelings about this. Everybody's kind of kumbaya on this, I guess. But I do think it's, for me, it's a little bit of a mixed thing. I fully recognize that we're putting people in situations where we want to make sure that the practitioners who are dealing with them are, you know, are reputable people and are going to be, you know, that we start out with the best folks that we can get. But I also feel like there's a, when we've moved as a society in this direction where you kind of now have to prove yourself, it isn't good enough that you just say that you don't have a background of some with some criminal history. You now have to give your fingerprints. It begins to me to feel pretty intrusive when we make people do that. So I really wanted to ask you, Ms. Brecken, you mentioned that you said not all applicants are as forthright as we'd like them to be, and you said that 37 states have these kinds of requirements. So I'm wondering if you have evidence that, you know, how many people lied, in fact, and would have been discovered through this process, or is there any evidence that in the other states that don't have this process that people are any less safe than they are in the places where we make people jump through these hoops?
Madam Chair, what I can describe to you is the situation that occurred in Kansas, and this was probably about 4 or 5 years ago now, when the Kansas Board of Nursing implemented the requirement for the criminal background checks. They continued to ask for have the same questions on their applications for licensure related to have you ever been convicted of a felony, gross misdemeanor, etc. They studied that for 2 years and compared the responses on the application to the hits they received through the criminal background check. And what they found was that 29% of the individuals who had a criminal conviction did not self-disclose it on their application. Now, it's important to recognize that many of those convictions were minor convictions, and I shouldn't ever call a conviction minor, but they were for things such as consumption of, you know, alcohol as a minor, or maybe something, you know, on their driving record. But the fact of the matter was that 29% of individuals, even though they knew they were going to be fingerprinted and subjected to a criminal background check, did not disclose those convictions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Sean.
You know, just to that point, I think you're on the track of what we've kind of highlighting some things for folks in society this year of, you know, maybe we need to be looking at this second chance theory, and which is a good thing, I'm supportive of too, because people can change their ways. But, you know, this is something that we make our school bus drivers do. They have to go in and give fingerprints, and if people are forthright to begin with, I think there's things that can be worked with. But, you know, it's kind of like these folks are given narcotics. I mean, you might be sedated and having a colonoscopy, and these are the types of folks that are working on you, and that's a pretty vulnerable situation. So I know some of us are laughing. It just seems like the right measure to do and move on in a positive way, to send a positive message that we're going to create an efficient way to do this and a standard way to do it.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Fritz was first, and then I'll go over you.
Representative Fritz. Thank you, Madam Chair, and to that point, the bus drivers being fingerprinted, and I, as an LPN in the nursing home, am fingerprinted and have a background check. Yeah, so it's not new. And when you look at the vulnerability of the patients and residents that we care for, and if whether they're coming out of the anesthesia from a colonoscopy, or they're just they've had a stroke, or they have their belongings, that they everything in their life that they have left to them is in their bedside drawer, and that could be taken by a thief, and that does happen. So I think we do need to pay close attention to making sure that doesn't happen, and that we do take the best that come to us that are lawful folks working, caring for the vulnerable people we care for.
Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, I partially agree with you and partially agree with them, and I was just wondering if this is one of the situations where the experts could tell me, is this something that where they need to keep it a long time, or is this one where we could get rid of it fairly soon after the check?
Yeah, good point, Representative Mullery. So you're talking about, for instance, destroying the fingerprints after the check is done.
Madam Chair?
Representative Jones.
So the next stop for this bill is civil law, and then the provisions in here, we're going to discuss that tomorrow about data. You know, where that fits into the spectrum of everybody else's data as well. And so I don't know that this maybe will be the spot to decide that today, other than I think it's going to be under the same auspices of anything else that falls under criminal background data. And I don't know if we want to carve out a specific niche for just this bill that says it has to be this way or that way, other than what it is standard across the state. Is that maybe answer your question, Representative Mullery?
Madam Chair, it answers it in a way I'm not quite sure I agree with, because we have other situations where we don't keep things, and so some we do, some we don't. And so this could be, I don't have enough, and that could be a different committee, however the chair wants to do it, but the experts at some point should say whether or not this is one of those where we need to keep it or we don't need to keep it. So I'm not knowledgeable enough on that.
Right, and this is the kind of discussion that would be had in civil law, I think, Representative Schoen, and so I'm, you know, it is going there. And I just want to say I appreciate the comments that are made. There is a real tension here. And, of course, we fingerprint some people and not others, and I do appreciate that we're handling all of these the same now in this bill, which is, I think that is a good thing. But I just really wanted to highlight the fact that there is a, it's really a sad thing that we're moving all in this direction. And I do think there is somewhat of a difference between the bus driver and the person who has gone to school for a number of years to get a license, who, you know, but I do agree they're in a, we're exposing people, vulnerable people. And, you know, so I'm not saying that I'm against the bill. I just want to highlight that it's a mixed thing. It's not just, you know, because we are going to be asking people, some of whom have done, had many years of training and supervised and all kinds of stuff, to give their fingerprints, which is a very, you know, not a good moment when you're asked to do that, although it may be a necessary moment. So, Ms. Brecken, you wanted to comment?
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I just wanted to share with you that FBI has some very specific requirements in terms of the storage of the fingerprints as well as their purpose. And when the criminal background checks are collected for the purpose of licensure, that is the only purpose they can be used for. They can't be kept and used for other purposes. So that really is addressed in federal law.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair. So I'd like to express agreement with you on the direction you're going, simply because, you know, if my daughter were going to school and found out after the fact, like Representative Loeffler pointed out, I think there's probably some time that we need to discuss with the higher ed folks to say, you know, if you're going to operate a program, you probably should, when folks are getting counseling on the direction they're going to go with a career, should have very clear guidelines to understand that these are the things that are going to preclude you from employment in this in the beginning, so maybe you shouldn't be, you know, spending your money on it. And here's what you can do to make sure that you can do that as far as change your reputation or et cetera. And I don't know if that's the direction you're talking either, Representative Loeffler, but I think we need to do better on the front end than wait for the back end.
All right, thank you. I'm going to let Representative Mullery make another comment, and then we're going to move on. Okay. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, after failing to get the legislature to act for 3 years on trying to do that with high school students, I want to say that our new education commissioner saw the light and did that, and it's now part of the curriculum to let students know that about those problems.
All right, thank you, Representative Mullery. Okay, so Representative Schoen renews his motion that House File 1002 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Schoen.
Thank you, members.
House File 256, Representative Fritz. Representative Fritz's bill may be the shortest bill of the year.
Yes, I saw that. The longest in committee.
Well, we'll see.
Andrea. Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Fritz moves that House File 256 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. So,
yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, this is the way to write a bill, just a repeal. And members, today, I've had this bill before this committee a few years back, and so I'm happy again to be back here with it. And I have with me three testifiers, so I'll be brief. And what I'm asking you to do is to repeal the family cap. We have, in Minnesota, we have, in 2003, we had a family cap put on families that were in the MFIP, the Minnesota Family Investment Program. And this harms children. And I want you to hear from those folks that deal with this much more than I do, but I certainly know quite a bit about it. And I have people from all across the segments of this. So I'm going to start with Jessica Webster from Legal Aid to my right, and then we're going to move to the Minnesota Citizens Concern for Life on my left, and then follow up with the Children's Defense Fund. So if I could just turn it over to my testifier, Jessica.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with the Legal Services Advocacy Project. What we're talking about today is the Minnesota Family Investment Program. Many of you know that that's the state's welfare to work program. How this program works is a family's grant is based on their household size. So a family of three gets a little bit more than a family of two. What the family cap did in 2003 was it said if a mom has a new baby while she's on the program, the state would deny assistance to that new child. And that was put into place in 2003. There were other states across the country, several other states across the country that also had family caps in place. And it was really based on this, what we perceive or what we know now is really a myth that women were having more children to get more money on assistance. And what we have now in Minnesota is 10 years of data that shows that the birth rate has stayed flat and that women were not having children to get $75 more a month. The birth rate stayed flat. We didn't stop low-income children from being born, so all we have done in the state of Minnesota is denied thousands of babies assistance for just based on their birth date, just based on when they were born. And states across the country have started to recognize that this is failed policy. The states of Maryland, New Jersey, and Illinois have repealed family cap policies, recognizing that they do not work. And so what we're asking today is that you do repeal the family cap policy and that we stop denying assistance to newborn babies. As most of you know, there are time limits in the Minnesota Family Investment Program. Most people are only on this program for 2 years. So what we're doing is we're denying assistance to babies between the time they're born and age two. And so you all know that's a really critical time for development. And for those of you who have had babies recently or grandbabies recently, you know how expensive it is. And even though $75 a month does not seem like a lot of money, it's a very significant amount of money to our families and to low-income families. So I believe there are a few more testifiers even than are behind me here, so I will end my testimony there. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Rao, and I represent Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. We are a grassroots pro-life organization representing more than 70,000 member families throughout Minnesota. And on behalf of those 70,000 member families, MCCL would like to express our support for this legislation and to thank Representative Fritz for bringing this legislation forward. The family cap legislation was passed, as stated before, during the 2003 legislative session. MCCL did oppose it at that time, and now today our opposition to this policy really has only intensified. Statistics obtained from the Minnesota Department of Human Services and the Department of Health provide, I think, some very important information. They show that more than 19,540 children in over 16,000 cases have had their grants reduced for at least 1 month due to the family cap. As Jessica stated earlier, birth rates in families that are under the family cap have not dropped. And during the time period from 2001 to 2010, the overall number of abortions dropped by 22%. However, the percentage of taxpayer-funded abortions being performed in our state has risen from 21% in 2001, prior to the family cap, up to 34% in 2010, after the family cap. The reasons why women have abortions in our state has remained relatively constant for many years. The annual abortion report, which is published on July 1st of every year, shows that women feel they cannot have a baby due to lack of financial, educational, and emotional support. Various academic institutions, including a widely cited study from Rutgers University, have concluded that not only do family caps not lower birth rates for poor families, but family caps seem to increase abortion rates, which is evidenced by our own numbers here in Minnesota. On behalf of our membership, we urge the Minnesota Legislature to readdress this failed policy and repeal the family cap. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Legislative Affairs and Advocacy Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. Children's Defense Fund primarily advocates for policies that do two things. One, that improve the well-being of children, especially children who are at great risk for developmental delay and poor outcomes. And number two, policies that strengthen the stability, the economic stability of families. And we believe that repealing the family cap does both. Generally, as you heard from Ms. Webster, the NFIP grant amount is based on family size. However, as you've heard, no adjustment is made for the additional cost of a newborn if the family was receiving NFIP assistance at the time of the baby's conception. This lack of funds further financially strains the approximately one out of every seven families receiving NFIP assistance with a newborn. The current NFIP grant leaves a family of three at 62% of the federal poverty guidelines, and if an additional child is born, their income is reduced to 51% of poverty as a result of the family cap. This is deep poverty and is highly correlated with poor childhood and adulthood outcomes. We believe that repealing the family cap is important for two reasons. First, the family cap pushes families deeper into poverty and at a time when families are under a great deal of stress, not just the stress associated with poverty and its associated experiences, but also the stresses associated with having a new baby. Later this week, my colleague Marcy Jeffers and I will be talking with you about maternal depression and its impact on early childhood. 44% of caregivers in MFIP families had a diagnosed mental health disorder in the last 3 years. The most frequent diagnosis? Depression. One longer-term solution for reducing the incidence of depression includes addressing the broader context in which depression occurs. The significant role that the emotional and financial strains of poverty impose should be considered when evaluating the family cap. And second, the deep poverty that results from failing to recognize the newborn child is especially harmful to the child and his or her siblings, especially if they are young. It is not solely poverty or the degree of poverty that matters for child outcomes, but when during childhood the poverty occurs. Poverty early in a child's life is especially harmful for outcomes related to achievement skills and cognitive development. This committee knows full well the critical importance of early childhood in regards to brain development and for establishing the neural functions and structures that shape future cognitive, social, emotional, and behavioral outcomes. From the little data we have on the 70,000 children receiving NFIP assistance each month, including the 35,000 children who are under the age of 6, we know they are not doing well. In fact, 61% of young children ages 3 months to 5 years screened as part of a pilot project that was discontinued in 2009 scored positive for possible cognitive, emotional, or behavioral delays. Increasing the incomes of families living in deep poverty by repealing the family cap can have a positive impact on child development. Repealing the family cap and thereby recognizing the additional costs associated with raising an additional child could result in approximately $75 per month or $900 per year for a child and his or her family. This amount is not insignificant. Before I close, I want to leave you with two pieces of information. First, findings from a 2011 Brookings Institution study examining the effects of family income on school readiness suggest that an additional $1,000 of average family income throughout early childhood can result in higher reading and math scores for children in low-income families. And number two, as far as outcomes during adulthood, according to a 2011 research study, for families with early childhood income below $25,000, a $3,000 annual boost to family income is associated with a 17% increase in adult earnings. Repealing the family cap can have a positive developmental impact on thousands of Minnesota children, and as a result, it can also have a positive impact on our state. So thank you for your time today, and thank you for your support.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jason Adkins. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Catholic Conference, which is the public policy voice of the Catholic Church in Minnesota. The case for the repeal of the family cap has been made very well today by our previous testifiers, and I don't want to belabor the argument, but I do want to make two quick points. First of all, we're very concerned about the way in which the family cap drives children and families deeper into poverty, particularly by withholding cash assistance from MFIP-eligible families with newborns. The family cap directly harms children, as Representative Fritz said, children who are not responsible for the acts of the adults in their lives. Second, and though it's difficult to show direct causation, there is at least a notable correlation between economic-related abortion rates and the 2003 enactment of the family cap. Since 2002, the rate of abortions in Minnesota performed for economic reasons has, according to the Minnesota Department of Health, doubled, even though the general abortion rate has decreased. So I think those are two important points and concerns from the Catholic Church in Minnesota. We thank Representative Fritz for offering this important bill and hope that you will enact a repeal of the family cap. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chairwoman Liebling and members of the committee, my name is Linnea House. I'm the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota, and I'm proud to be here to show our support for the repeal of this law. As the law currently stands, you know that the family cap within the MFIP program actively denies family support for low-income children born to low-income women. At all levels of our work, of public policy work, NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota supports programs that allow women to make the reproductive health choices that are best for them and for their families. This current law is a means of controlling those reproductive health care decisions, and we believe that low income deserve to have the support to deliver and raise the children the same as every other Minnesotan. Minnesota public policy should not allow politicians to interfere with a woman's ability to determine her family size based solely on her income. In addition, it is particularly concerning that the current statute also states that there are exceptions for coverage if the child was conceived as a result of sexual assault or incest, provided that the incident has been reported to a law enforcement agency. This exception, in our opinion, collides with personal privacy by requiring patients and parents to disclose to the state of Minnesota how a child was conceived and their private reproductive choices. We strongly oppose any types of personal privacy exceptions placed into Minnesota law. Finally, a continued investment into family planning programs that allow all Minnesota women the ability and the autonomy to make decisions about when to start or to expand their families is critical. Nearly a quarter million Minnesota women are in need of public-supported family planning services, and I urge your continued support of those investments as well. I urge you all to vote yes on House File 256. I thank you for your time.
Thank you. And members, we will rarely see a coalition like this one.
Where's the camera?
So, questions for members. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the testifiers, and it is good to see people of such opposing views all testify for the same bill. Okay. I guess I have a couple of questions. Isn't there other benefits that person on MFIP would qualify for if they did have an additional children other than just additional cash benefits?
Ms. Webster?
Chair Liebling and Representative Grunhagen, yes, under SNAP, or what is also known as food stamps, those are not capped to family size, so you would receive a small increase for your newborn in SNAP.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. The other thing, I do find it disconcerting that the abortion rate has gone up among the poor, even though abortion in general has declined, and that is an additional fact that I didn't have before. I would say this: I guess I'd like to see additional benefits for women who have children in a traditional marriage relationship under MFIP. In other words, hey, if you have the child and you're married, on MFIP, then you would get an additional money over and above just what the current reimbursement is. And that just sends the message that to reinforce traditional marriage when we have so many programs in government that undermine traditional marriage. The other thing I guess I'd like to see, and I don't know if that could be a part of the bill or not, is stronger consequences to men who father children outside of wedlock. I'm not exactly sure. I've been running so many different directions with the health insurance exchange and education finance, but you know, we need to start building public policy that rewards having children within marriage, and number two, brings strong consequences to men who father children outside of marriage, especially if those women are on government programs. Let me just make one final comment, Madam Chair.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I would just encourage people to do a little research on your own. The Heritage Foundation has a lot of studies on that. I've quoted some of them in the past. I won't go over it again. And also, Star Parker. She is a black lady who has been on welfare for years, in fact had a number of abortions, and she wrote a number of books. One of them was Uncle Sam's Plantation, and she is strongly in favor of reforming welfare in a way that reinforces traditional marriage. I, you know, whatever you subsidize, you get more of, and I know there's been some statistics shared here, but if you look at the long-term effect of government programs on traditional marriage, especially welfare, it's undermined it. And it's contributed to a large increase in the number of children outside of wedlock. And that, in effect, is contrary to good public policy and to the benefit of the children in the long run. So anyway, if you have any observations or responses to that, I'd be open to it.
I'm going to go to Representative Abler. Representative Abler, you're next. If you want to respond, go ahead.
I think I'll let it stand as a statement. Anyway, so I just wanted to echo what you had said earlier about it's nice that people can get together. I want to remind people about the Positive Alternatives Program that still existed through two different administrations and reductions, and that was the same product here. So I just like it when we can work this way once in a while at least. So thanks, Madam Chair.
Okay. Is there anybody else here who wants to testify for or against the bill? I forgot to ask that earlier. Okay, not seeing anybody. Other members with questions?
Sounds like a good bill. Let's just vote for it.
Okay. Representative Fritz, do you want to have the last word?
Well, Madam Chair and members, absolutely. Thank you all. And I think we're all of the same mindset here today. And I'm very happy that we, or the four of us here, are able to testify from the different walks of life that we come from, because punishing and keeping food from babies is not the answer. And so this is a good repealer, and I would appreciate a yes vote from everyone. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fritz. Representative Fritz renews her motion that House File 256 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Fritz. Representative Schumacher.
On my way.
House File 1179. And Representative Schumacher moves that House File 1179 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. And to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1179 is an MDH bill that deals with federal conformity over the resource utilization guides that are used in the state. In your packets, there are three sheets that explain what the resource utilization guides are all about and a little bit about what this bill is doing. But a little bit of background on that, I carried the bill in 2011 to institute the RUG 4 as it is now. Previously in statute, it was the RUG 3. And the reason that we had done that then was that in 2007 and 2008, CMS had done a study nationwide to find out what nursing facilities were experiencing and what kind of services that they were providing to the residents to see if that really fit with what they were reimbursing for. And they found some changes, and the results of those changes came into the RUG 4. And so we did some conformity in 2011 to make sure that the nursing facilities weren't operating under RUG 3 in Minnesota and RUG 4 at the federal level. And this bill is just taking RUG 3 out of the picture completely, so that we're just using RUG 4 overall. Part of the difference between the two that you'll see is when we classify residents, now under RUG 3 there was about 36 different types of classifications. Now we've been able to hone that, well, CMS, not we. CMS has been able to hone that a little bit more and classify things so that there are now 48 different types of classifications. Those allow facilities to get better reimbursements and provide better care for those residents. In addition to the conforming language that's in there on lines 8.2 and 8.3, there's some language about the charging duplication fees for copies that facilities may have when there is a challenge or an appeal to what the classification rate is for a particular resident. And then from lines 9.26 on, we consolidate audits that are conducted on nursing facilities. Currently, there are three different types of audits that are conducted in a facility. There's the pool, the targeted, and the special. And the targeted and the special are used very infrequently, and so we are just combining those to have it so we have the pool, which is the annual, and then the special, which is used when needed. So with that, I would stand for questions, and we do have Marcia Martinson from the department here to answer any technical questions and go from there.
All right. Thank you, Representative Schumacher. That was very good. I just wonder if you would, you use the term RUG 3, RUG 4, and I'm not sure that all the members of the committee know what that is. Could you just back up a little and just kind of explain the very basic so that everybody's on the same page?
Absolutely, and that's part of the handouts that we have too, explaining that more. But RUG stands for Resource Utilization Guide, and when a patient or when a resident is admitted into a nursing facility, they go through a survey, the MDS, which is a great read if you ever have the opportunity to go through. And then they get classified based on that so that they can get accurate skill levels and accurate reimbursements for what they're performing. And they call that the Resource Utilization Guide, and that's what they base decisions on there. So we're really enhancing it with this bill.
Thank you. Okay, questions for members. Representative Abler.
So, Representative Schumacher, we're not pulling the rug out. We're just getting rid of the old rug. Sorry. So would you say that nursing homes are important to Minnesota?
Madam Chair, I see we have about 15 minutes left, if I can use all that time to answer that question. But, yes, very important.
Representative Schumacher. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. And then we've got a testifier. Did you want to add to what Representative Schumacher had to say? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marcy Martinson, and I am with the Case Mix program in the Minnesota Department of Health. When I come up here with Representative Schumacher, I always feel redundant. He does a wonderful job. I don't think I have anything to add, but if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify for or against this bill? Not seeing any. Any other questions for members? Okay, here's your opportunity to learn a lot about nursing homes. All right. I'm not seeing any questions. So, Representative Schumacher renews his motion that House File 1179 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails.
The bill is passed.
And members, we have finished our agenda and we are adjourned. No meeting tonight.